We're going to be looking at the backbone of the Bible. And when you talk about the backbone of something, you're talking about serious business. We're not talking about the little toe or the little finger or the hair. We're talking about the backbone. And when you say backbone, that pretty well expresses the whole of it, the substance of it. And that's what we're going to be looking for. I saw a bumper sticker once that said, "Of all the things I've lost, it's my mind that I miss the most." But of all the things that a Christian can lose, or all the things that a church can lose, the thing that we'll miss most is its sense of mission. If you lose your sense of mission, you've lost it. All of your religious activity really comes to mean nothing if you lose your sense of mission. If you lose the sense of why, we've dealt a lot with what, but if we lose our sense of why, forget it. It's over. You end up going through just ritual, meaningless, senseless ritual. And even your faith becomes a getting all dressed up and nowhere to go. Well, what's the purpose of it all? When life loses its purpose, there's no real reason to live. When religion loses its purpose, if we lose our sense of mission, then there's not any real sense of being here. And there's no sense of doing what we do. There's no sense of doing without what we do without. There's no sense of being if you lose your sense of mission. But with it, if we can catch a glimpse of what our mission is, if we can sense that, then, by the way, everything that's done will be defined by that mission. And everything then that we do will have tremendous impact and purpose. But we've got to focus on the mission. We've got to focus on the goal, on where we're headed. You don't just start out and, like last Sunday we said, jump in a cab and say, "Step on it," and not say where you're going. And because you never will know whether you've gotten there. If you get, you wouldn't know it if you recognized it. So it's so important that at the class here at this hour and the hour next hour, we're going to be focusing on that, the big picture. We're going to be focusing on what we're about. And we're going to be going at it from two different angles. This that we're looking at the class is a big, broad overview taken with a wide-angle lens, if you'll let me use that illustration. A wide-angle lens. And then the second hour, we're going to be using the telephoto lens that narrows down and focuses on a small, but focuses on a specific target. Now, with that introduction, the ultimate motivation comes from being a part of the ultimate mission. Do you ever have trouble getting up in the mornings? What a dumb question. I don't mean getting awake, but do you have trouble getting motivated to get up at all? I think probably the only thing that's going to get you and me out of the bed every day for the rest of our lives is to recognize that we are an integral part of the ultimate mission. Now, if we can catch that we are an integral part of the ultimate mission, that is what will get you out of the bed. It's what gets you going. It's what gives you direction. It's what keeps your adrenaline flowing. It's what keeps a smile on your face. It's what allows you to be happy when you're persecuted. If you know what you're about. Now, if we can do that, if I can be a part of helping us find that, boy, that'll be worth any amount of energy, any amount of time, if we can just figure out what that is. There is a unifying, overarching theme in the Bible. It is what I'm referring to as the backbone of the Bible. It has to do with the Jewish nation, the Hebrew nation. And it has to do with us, whom the Bible refers to as the nations. The nations. The ethnoi. That's the Greek word, the ethnoi. What word do we get from that? Ethnic. It's simply a transliteration, virtually, of the word ethnoi, the ethnic, the nation, the nations. And the ethnoi is the plural, and it just simply means the people. Anybody that's not a Jew is an ethnoi, is a part of the nations. They were called the nation, the people, and the others were called the nations. And it's that way all the way through the Scriptures. The Scriptures deal with both of them. We are the nations, they are the nation. The uniform theme is written in, it's written in hard copy. The overall theme is written in hard copy, and that hard copy consists of this revelation. 66 books written over a 1400 year period by about 40 different authors of varying backgrounds, diverse interests, diverse education, some with none, some with much. And yet all the way through it, there's this golden thread of continuity. It's the most astonishing accomplishment and characteristic of any literature in the entire world. Nothing can touch this. Nothing as far as its makeup, as far as its message, as far as its continuity. I'm serious, and I'm not just saying this to say something. I am absolutely bowled over by the continuity and that golden thread that stretches all the way from Genesis through Revelation. It's magnificent. Are any of you Jewish in background? If you are, raise your hand, please. Do you have any? You mean we have nobody that's a part of the root system? We're all grafted in branches. We're the losers for that. We have a man coming in here March the 29th or 31st, the last Sunday of March. A man's coming in who is Jewish. He is a converted Jew. He's what they call a complete Jew. The Jews refer to themselves as complete Jews if they're Christians. He's coming in to do for us the Seder, the Jewish feast of Passover. And we're going to get a chance to touch and come in contact with a person who is of the same lineage of Jesus of Nazareth and who has come, contrary to the nation that he's a part of, he has come to recognize Jesus as the Messiah. And it's exciting, and I'm delighted to have to be here to be a part of that. This Bible, this book, it's called the book. It's called the book, and it could be looked at as a kind of light. There are two kinds of light. One is called coherent light, and the other is called ambient light. Are any scientists here can define coherent light and ambient light? Oh, we might have anybody that knows the difference between coherent and ambient. Define it for me, Ridge. This is ambient light. It's like people strolling through a park. All the parts of it just kind of, they're not organized. They just flow out from all different directions. Give me an example of coherent light. All right, even that's it. Give me another one that's even more.
A laser.
A laser can cut through steel. That's coherent light. Which do you think would be more in the... Is this coherent or ambient light? You say yes. Alan would have thought of that one. Would this come nearer being coherent or... Of course, we coherent in the sense of making sense, or ambient. Now, coherent, we know. But is this more concentrated and focused, or is this an ambient light? Which you all who think this is would be termed or likened to coherent light, raise your hand. All who think this would be more ambient light, raise your hand. We're pretty well balanced, church. Actually, this is a more likened to coherent light. This is a focused revelation of God. Why and how has it focused? What is its focus? On what people? This is focused. The revelation here is primarily recording the revelation of God to a one nation people, the Jewish people. Now there are some places in it where we have revelations that have come to other people. Do you have any examples right off the top of your head where we have included in here, in their own language, we have in the originals, we have it in their language, their revelation from God? The man lived in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar has a psalm, has a song that he composed, a song of praise to God in here. And the conversation between him and God is recorded in here. Now that's an example of God revealing himself outside this laser beam. Next Sunday we're going to look at the ambient light contribution. All of the surrounding material, and boy, there I've got some things that I'll share with you that give you the supplementary revelation that God has given to the nations around the Jewish nation that backs up, that substantiates and verifies and it confirms the revelation to the Jews. It overlaps with it, and we'll look at that next week. So let me just turn on this and give you just a... You see Genesis 12 there. And we started there because we're going to talk next Sunday. We're going to talk today about Genesis 1 through 11. And next Sunday we're going to look at Genesis 12, and we'll have already alluded to it last Sunday, that the Genesis 12 is really the first chapter of the Bible. And I say that with caution because I'm not showing any kind of... I'm not reflecting badly on the first 11 chapters. But what I'm doing is looking at the whole thing as a story, as a record of what God is doing here. And the first 11 chapters of Genesis is introductory. It's getting us up to the theme of the entire rest of the Bible. The entire rest of the revelation begins in chapter 12. Now that kind of shocked me when I first found it some years ago. I found it and became aware of it in reading a book called Eternity in Their Hearts. Eternity in Their Hearts. And if you can get a copy of the book, get it and read it. In it, the author makes this affirmation that the Bible, actually, the story begins in chapter 12, the story of what God is trying to do. Chapters 1 through 11 are introductory, and we'll look at how it's introductory in just a few moments. But if you'll notice, the law of Moses, and using that as being the Torah, and then you've got the prophets and the Psalms, you've got the Gospels, the Acts of Apostles, the letters, the Revelation, and all of that, from Genesis 12 all the way through to the book of Revelation, there is this common thread of the continuity, this common laser light, and we're going to notice what that is. But for this morning, let's notice chapters 1 through 11 as introductory. Where is the greatest criticism? Where is the greatest criticism that's leveled against the Bible? Where is it focused? The first 11 chapters. That's where the critics who question the authenticity of the text as a record of reality, they focus their attention on chapters 1 through 11. On which events? Creation? The flood? The Tower of Babel? Yeah. You babbled. That's exactly what the problem was. The fall of man, at least couched in the language that it's couched in, as being a serpent tempting Adam and Eve with a piece of fruit. They've either referred to that as, oh, that's just symbolic. The length of days of the length of the creation. What's the options? It all took place in seven 24-hour days. And then the other option is that it took place in seven periods. So there's a lot of controversy, a lot of discussion even among religious people, and then there's a lot of derision being heaped upon these first 11 chapters. It's interesting to me that the place where Jesus focused most of his attention, as far as examples that he used, he focused it on those first 11 chapters in Genesis. Now, give me some examples of that. Things that he referred to. from the beginning. He went right on back to the very beginning. From the beginning, he made them male and female. He spoke of the flood. How did he speak of the flood? You remember, he did it now. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. They'll be eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. There's the flood there. And guess who in the recent months has done a television series on this section of the Bible? Bill Moyer. On not just the first 11 chapters. I don't know whether he went past that or not. But much of it had to do with this. There are some great events that take place in these first 11 chapters. Let's look at them. Number one, the primary cause of the universe is mentioned here. The primary cause. The Bible assumes the primary cause. There are two options. Either matter is eternal or spirit is eternal. Those two options. There aren't any other two options that I know of. Either matter is eternal or spirit is eternal. Why is that true? Why are there no other options? Okay, there's a principle, though, that even scientists acknowledge as being true, and that Maria is aware of. Nothing comes from nothing. You remember when they were standing there in the gazebo and nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could. Nothing comes from nothing. You don't get something out of nothing. It just doesn't happen. Therefore, since we know matter exists, either matter was always here, and everything that we see came about as a result of just sheer collision of atoms and all molecules, just out of pure chance. And everything here is a matter just of pure random chance and time. But you know, that doesn't make sense. Why does it not make sense that all this just happened by chance and that matter was always eternal and it's here and it just happened by chance over billions of years and just, by the way, all of a sudden here we are? Why does that not... Does that make sense to you? Now, you're Christians. It doesn't make sense to you because... But why does it not make sense to you? Why could you go to a person who is not a believer and say, you know what? That doesn't really make sense, does it? Why does it not make sense to you?
I mean, there would be no purpose.
Okay, and everything that we know has purpose, or else we discard it. That's one reason. Either the universe itself has purpose, or else where did we come to the idea that only what has purpose is of any value? Secondly, the design of it. You can't get order out of chaos without intelligence. It never has happened. Never has it ever happened. Yes. Oh, you mean you have to put a magnifying glass down in order to concentrate that sun's light to start a fire, okay? No, it's not rational. There's a law of entropy that says what? Everything left on its own does what? Breaks down and goes downhill. Everything, the law of entropy. It's the second law of, what's it called, the second law of dynamics? Thermodynamics. And it just simply means that everything you witness either rusts, rots, or ruins if it's left on its own. And yet here we are sitting in a universe that seems to continually be renewed. It just doesn't make sense that it all just happened and that matter is eternal. And guess what's happening in scientific circles today? More and more scientists are coming to debunk the evolutionary theory and to disown it and to separate themselves from it, and more it's becoming okay and the norm to say, to speak of this as being created and as being a designed entity. So that's the flow today. We're watching it happen. We're not quite sure how it's going to pan out. Look here. Let me just, Jim, hold on a minute. Let's look at this again and just try to get through this. The primary cause being God, the creation, it exists. There's no question about it. How did it come about? Chapters 1 and 2. Then chapter 3 and 4 is the fall, the sum up of the disastrous nature of the results of the revolt and the fall of man, wanting to go our own way. The question, am I my brother's keeper? Have you ever heard of any one question that has continued longer than this one and that so nearly represents the quandary that we find ourselves in today, 6,000 or 7,000 years later? Am I my brother's keeper? Every one of us has heard that spoken on the television, in terms of social conditions and all. Am I my brother's keeper? That's what Cain said shortly after the creation and shortly after the fall. When it says that God made them male and female, He made us in the image of God, male and female. May I just make this reference? There is a tendency today to accept homosexuality as a viable alternative lifestyle. May I say that it is an alternative lifestyle, but that it never has been viable. It never will be viable. It is a disgrace to God. It's a disgrace on us, on people. Why is it not viable? Is it an alternative lifestyle? Yes. Do you agree or disagree that it is not a viable alternative lifestyle? How do you know it's not viable? One generation is all it'll take. Now, what do we mean? What do you mean by that? It cannot reproduce. It cannot procreate. Male and male never will produce life. Female and female will never produce life. If you want to test any philosophy, test it with this one premise or with this one question. What if that were made universal? If it's an alternative, viable lifestyle, what if that were made universal? The answer comes to us without any question, without any compromise or any ambiguity. We wouldn't last but one generation. The entire human race would become extinct if that philosophy were made universal. It only brings death. It has brought it in many ways, but it would bring it just as simply as a natural outcome of what would happen if you brought the two male and male together, or female and female together, and said, this is an alternative, viable lifestyle. That's just simply not true. And you can make that, there's no question about that. Put it to the test of universality. Then you've got the genealogy from Adam to Noah through Seth, chapter 5, chapter 6 through 9, the flood, the repeopling of the earth through the descendants of Noah, chapter 10, the confusion of languages and dispersing of the nation, chapter 11. Next Sunday, I'll try to bring a map of the dispersion of all the nations and where they went, and how the Europeans came about from Japheth, and how that the Hamites populated the warmer regions, and how the Sethites, the descendants of Seth, became the Hebrew nation. We'll look at that next Sunday.